Second iteration. Derby Day. He is frozen in mid-stride as he edges diagonally into the depths of the holiday crowd. The angle of aperture has captured a fraction of his face. High cheekbone, thick dark beard trimmed close, right ear, stray lock of hair visible between corduroy coat collar and striped cap. The cuffs of his dark trousers, buttoned tight in leather spats above hobnailed walking boots, are speckled to the shins with the chalky mud of Surrey. The left epaulette of his worn, waterproof coat buttons sturdily over the strap of a military-issue binocular case. The lapels flap open in the heat, showing stout, gleaming toggles of brass. His hands are jammed deep in the long coat's pockets. His name is Edward Mallory. He tramped through a lacquered gleam of carriages, blinded horses cropping noisily at the turf, amid childhood smells of harness, sweat, and grassy dung. His hands inventoried the contents of his various pockets. Keys, cigar case, billfold, card case. The thick staghorn handle of his multi-bladed Sheffield knife. Field notebook, most precious item of all. A handkerchief, a pencil stub, a few loose shillings. A practical man, Dr. Mallory knew that every sporting crowd has its thieves, none of them dressed to match their station. Anyone here might be a thief. It is a fact. It is a risk. A woman blundered into Mallory's path, and his hobnails tore the flounce of her skirt. Turning, wincing, she tugged herself loose with a squeak of crinoline as Mallory touched his cap and marched quickly on. Some farmer's wife, a clumsy, great red-cheeked creature, civilized and English as a dairy cow. Mallory's eye was still accustomed to a wilder breed, the small brown wolf women of the Cheyenne, with their greased black braids and beaded leather leggings. The hoop skirts in the crowd around him seemed some aberrant stunt of evolution. The daughters of Albion had got a regular scaffolding under there now, all steel and whalebone. Bison, that was it. American bison, just that very hoop-skirt silhouette when the big rifle took them down. They had a way of falling in the tall grass, suddenly legless, a furry hillock of meat. The great Wyoming herds would stand quite still for death, merely twitching their ears in puzzlement at the distant report of the rifle. Now Mallory threaded his way among this other herd, astonished that mere fashion could carry its mysterious impetus so far. The men among their ladies seemed a different species, nothing so extreme, save perhaps their shiny toppers, though his inner eye refused to find any hat exotic. He knew too much about hats, knew too many of the utterly mundane secrets of their manufacture. He could see at a glance that most of the hats around him were dead cheap, engine-made, pre-cut in a factory, though looking very nearly as fine as a craftsman hatter's work, and at half the price or less. He had helped his father in the little haberdashery in Lewis, punching, stitching, blocking, sewing. His father, dipping felt in the mercury bath, had seemed not to mind the stench. Mallory was not sentimental about the eventual death of his father's trade. He put it from his mind, seeing that drink was being sold from a striped canvas tent, men crowding the counter, wiping foam from their mouths. A thirst struck him at the sight of it. Veering around a trio of sporting gents, crops under their arms, who argued the day's odds, he reached the counter and tapped it with a shilling.
"Pleasure, sir?" asked the barman. "A Hucklebuff." "Sussex man, sir?" "I am. Why?" "Can't make you a proper Hucklebuff, sir, as I haven't barley water," the fellow explained, looking briskly sad. "Not much call for it outside Sussex." "Very nearly 2 years since I've tasted Hucklebuff," Mallory said. "Mix you a lovely bumbo, sir. Much like a Hucklebuff, no?" "A good cigar, then. Only tuppence. Fine Virginia weed."
The barman presented a crooked cheroot from a wooden box. Mallory shook his head.
"When I've the taste for something, I'm a stubborn man. A Hucklebuff or nothing."
The barman smiled.
"Won't be drove? A Sussex man, sure. I'm a county man myself. Take this fine cigar gratis, sir, with my compliments." "Very decent of you," Mallory said, surprised.
He strolled off, shaking a lucifer from his cigar case. Firing the match on his boot, he puffed the cheroot into life and tucked his thumbs jauntily in the armholes of his waistcoat. The cigar tasted like damp gunpowder. He yanked it from his mouth. A cheap paper band girdled the foul greenish-black leaf, a little foreign flag with stars and bars and the motto, Victory Brand. Yankee war rubbish. He flung it away so that it bounced, sparking from the side of a gypsy wagon, where a dark-headed child in rags snatched it quickly up. To Mallory's left, a spanking new steam gurney chugged into the crowd, the driver erect at his station. As the man drew his brake lever, a bronze bell clanged in the gurney's maroon prow, people scattering sulkily before the vehicle's advance. Above them, passengers lounged in velvet coach seats, the folding spark shield accordioned back to admit the sun. A grinning old swell in kid gloves sipped champagne with a pair of young misses, either daughters or mistresses. The gurney's door gleamed with a coat of arms, cogwheel azure and crossed hammers argent. Some rad's emblem unknown to Mallory, who knew the arms of every savant lord, though he was weak on the capitalists. The machine was headed east, toward the Derby garages. He fell in behind it, letting it clear his path, easily keeping pace and smiling as Drayman struggled with frightened horses. Pulling his notebook from his pocket, stumbling a little in the gouged turf tracks of the broom's thick wheels, he thumbed through the colourful pages of his spotter's guide. It was last year's edition. He could not find the coat of arms. Pity, but it meant little when new lords were ennobled weekly. As a class, the lordships dearly loved their steam chariots. The machine set its course for the gouts of greyish vapour rising behind the pillared grandstands of Epsom. It humped slowly at the curb of a paved access road. Mallory could see the garages now, a long, rambling structure in the modern style, girded in skeletal iron and roofed with bolted sheets of tin plate, its hard lines broken here and there by bright pennants and tin-capped ventilators. He followed the huffing landcraft until it eased into a stall. The driver popped valves with a steaming gush. Stable monkeys set to work with greasing gear as the passengers decamped down a folding gangway, the lord and his two women passing Mallory on their way toward the grandstand. Britain's self-made elite. They trusted he was watching and ignored him serenely. The driver lugged a massive hamper in their wake. Mallory touched his own striped cap, identical with the driver's, and winked, but the man made no response. Strolling the length of the garages, spotting steamers from his guidebook, Mallory marked each new sighting with his pencil stub, and a small thrill of satisfaction. Here was Faraday, great savant physicist of the Royal Society. There, Colgate, the soap magnate. And here, a catch indeed, the visionary builder Brunel. A very few machines bore old family arms, landowners whose fathers had been dukes and earls when such titles had existed. Some of the fallen old nobility could afford a steam, some had more initiative than others, and did what they could to keep up. Arriving at the southern wing, Mallory found it surrounded by a barricade of clean, new sawhorses, smelling of pitch. This section, reserved for the racing steamers, was patrolled by a squad of uniformed foot police. One of them carried a spring-wind Cutts Maudsley of a model familiar to Mallory. The Wyoming expedition had been provided with six of them. Though the Cheyenne had regarded the stubby Birmingham-made machine carbine with a useful awe, Mallory knew that it was temperamental to the point of unreliability, inaccurate to the point of uselessness as well, unless one were popping off the entire 30 rounds into a pack of pursuers, something Mallory himself had once done from the aft-firing position of the expedition's steam fortress. Mallory doubted that the fresh-faced young copper had any notion what a Cutts Maudsley might do if fired into an English crowd. He shook off the dark thought with an effort. Beyond the barricade, each separate stall was carefully shielded from spies and odds-makers by tall baffles of tarpaulin, tautly braced by criss-crossed cables threaded through flagpoles. Mallory worked his way through an eager crowd of gawkers and steam hobbyists. Two coppers stopped him brusquely at the gate. He displayed his citizen's number card and his engraved invitation from the Brotherhood of Vapor Mechanics. Making careful note of his number, the policeman checked it against a thick notebook crammed with fanfold. At length they pointed out the location of his hosts, cautioning him not to wander. As a further precaution, the Brotherhood had appointed their own lookout. The man squatted on a folding stool outside the tarpaulin, squinting villainously and clutching a long iron spanner. Mallory proffered his invitation. The guard stuck his head past a narrow flap in the tarpaulin, shouted, "Your brother's here, Tom," and ushered Mallory through. Daylight vanished in the stink of grease, metal shavings, and coal dust. Four vapor mechanics, in striped hats and leather aprons, were checking a blueprint by the harsh glare of a carbide lamp. Beyond them, a queer shape threw off highlights from curves of enameled tin. He took the thing for a boat, in the first instant of his surprise, its scarlet hull absurdly suspended between a pair of great wheels. Driving wheels, he saw, stepping closer. The burnished piston brasses vanished into smoothly flared openings in the insubstantial-looking shell or hull. Not a boat. It resembled a teardrop, rather, or a great tadpole. A third wheel, quite small and vaguely comical, was swivel-mounted at end of the long tapered tail. He made out the name painted in black and gilt across the bulbous prow, beneath a curved expanse of delicately leaded glass. Zephyr.
"Come, Ned, join us!" his brother sang out, beckoning. "Don't be shy!"
The others chuckled at Tom's sauciness as Mallory strode forward, his hobnails scraping the floor. His little brother Tom, 19 years old, had grown his first moustache. It looked as though a cat could lick it off. Mallory offered his hand to his friend, Tom's master.
"Mr. Michael Godwin, sir," he said.
"Dr. Mallory, sir," said Godwin, a fair-haired engineer of 40 years with mutton-chop whiskers over cheeks pitted by smallpox. Small and stout, with shrewd hooded eyes, Godwin began a bow, thought better of it, clapped Mallory gently across the back, and introduced his fellows. They were Elijah Douglas, a journeyman, and Henry Chesterton, a master of the second degree.
"A privilege, sirs," Mallory declared. "I expected fine things from you, but this is a revelation.
What do you think of her, Dr. Mallory? A far cry from our steam fortress, I should say."
"She was never made for your Wyoming," Godwin said, "and that accounts for a certain lack of guns and armour. Form emerges from function, as you so often told us."
"Small for a racing gurney, isn't she?"
Mallory ventured, somewhat at a loss.
"Peculiarly shaped."
"Built upon principles, sir. Newly discovered principles, indeed. And a fine tale behind her invention, having to do with a colleague of yours. You recall the late Professor Rudwick, I'm sure."
"Ah, yes, Rudwick,"
Mallory muttered, then hesitated.
"Hardly your new principal man, Rudwick."
Douglas and Chesterton were watching him with open curiosity.
"We were both paleontologists," Mallory said, suddenly uncomfortable. "But the fellow fancied himself gentry of a sort, put on fine airs and entertained outmoded theories, rather muddy in his thinking, in my opinion."
The two mechanics looked doubtful.
"I'm not one to speak ill of the dead," Mallory assured them. "Rudwick had his friends, I've mine, and there's an end to it."
"You do remember," Godwin persisted, "Professor Rudwick's great flying reptile?"
"Quetzalcoatlus,"
Mallory said. "Indeed, that was a coup. One can't deny it."
"They've studied its remains in Cambridge," Godwin said, "at the Institute of Engine Analytics."
"I plan to do a bit of work there myself, on the Brontosaurus,"
Mallory said, unhappy with the direction the conversation seemed to be taking.
"You see," Godwin continued, "the cleverest mathematicians in Britain were snug there, spinning their great brass, while you and I froze in the mud of Wyoming, pecking holes in their cards to puzzle out how a creature of such a size could fly."
"I know about the project," Mallory said. "Rudwick published on the topic. But pneumodynamics isn't my field. Frankly, I'm not sure there's much to it scientifically. It seems a bit, well, airy, if you follow me."
He smiled.
"Great practical applications, possibly," Godwin said. "Lord Babbage himself took a hand in the analysis."
Mallory thought about it.
"I'll concede there's likely something to pneumatics, then, if it's caught the eye of the great Babbage. To improve the art of ballooning, perhaps. Balloon flight, that's a military field. There's always ample funding for the sciences of war."
"No, sir. I mean in the practical design of machinery."
"A flying machine, you mean?"
Mallory paused.
"You're not trying to tell me this vehicle of yours can fly, are you?"
The mechanics laughed politely.
"No," Godwin said. "And I can't say that all that airy engine spinning has come to much directly, but we now understand certain matters having to do with the behaviour of air in motion, the principles of atmospheric resistance. New principles, little known as yet."
"But we mechanics," said Mr. Chesterton proudly, "have put them to practical use, sir, in the shaping of our Zephyr."
"Line streaming, we call it," Tom said.
So you've line-streamed this gurney of yours, eh? That's why it looks so much
like a fish, Tom said.
Exactly, said Godwin. A fish. It's all to do with the action of fluids, you see. Water, air, chaos and turbulence. It's all in the calculations.
Remarkable, Mallory said.
So I take it that these principles of turbulence...
A sudden blistering racket erupted from a neighbouring stall. The walls shook and a fine sifting of soot fell from the ceiling.
"That'll be the Italians," Godwin shouted. "They've brought in a monster this year."
"Makes a mortal hogo of a stink," Tom complained.
Godwin cocked his head.
"Hear them try rods clacking on the downstroke? Bad tolerances. Slovenly foreign work."
He doffed his cap and dusted soot against his knee. Mallory's head was ringing.
"Let me buy you a drink," he shouted.
Godwin cupped his ear blankly.
"What?"
Mallory pantomimed, lifting a fist to his mouth with his thumb cocked. Godwin grinned. He had a quick, bellowed word with Chesterton over the blueprints, then Godwin and Mallory ducked out into the sunshine.
"Bad try, Rods," the guard outside said smugly.
Godwin nodded and handed the man his leather apron. He took a plain black coat instead and traded his engineer's cap for a straw wide-awake. They left the racing enclosure.
"I can only spare a few minutes," Godwin apologized. "The master's eye melts the metal, as they say."
He hooked a pair of smoked spectacles over his ears.
"Some of these hobbyists know me and might try to follow us. But never mind that. It's good to see you again, Ned. Welcome back to England."
"I won't keep you long," Mallory said. "I wanted a private word or two. About the boy and such."
"Oh, Tom's a fine lad," said Godwin. "He's learning. He means well.
I hope he'll prosper."
"We do our best," Godwin said. "I was sorry to hear from Tom about your father, him taking so ill and all." "Old Mallory, he won't a-go till he's guv away his last bride,"
Mallory quoted in his broadest Sussex drawl.
"That's what father always tells us. He wants to see all his girls married. He's a game sort, my poor old dad." "He must take great comfort in a son like yourself," Godwin said. "So, how does London suit you? Did you take the holiday train?"
"I've not been in London. I've been in Lewes with a family. Rode the morning train from there to Leatherhead. Then I tramped it."
"You walked to the Derby from Leatherhead? That's 10 miles or more."
Mallory smiled.
"You've seen me tramp 20 cross-country in the badlands of Wyoming, hunting fossils. I had a taste to see good English countryside again. I'm only just back from Toronto with all our crates of plastered bones, while you've been here for months getting your fill of this."
He waved his arm. Godwin nodded.
"What do you make of the place, then, now you're home again?"
"London Basin Anticline," Mallory said. "Tertiary and Eocene chalk beds. Bit of modern flinty clay."
Godwin laughed.
"We're all of us modern flinty clay. Here we go, then. These lads sell a decent brew."
They walked down a gentle slope to a crowded dray laden with ale kegs. The proprietors had no Hucklebuff. Mallory bought a pair of pints.
"It was good of you to accept our invitation," Godwin said. "I know that you're a busy man, sir, what with your famous geologic controversies and such."
"No busier than yourself," Mallory said.
"Solid engineering work, directly practical and useful. I envy that, truly." "No, no," said Godwin. "That brother of yours, he thinks the world of you. So do we all. You're the coming man, Ned. Your star is rising."
"We had excellent luck in Wyoming, certainly," Mallory said. "We made a great discovery. But without you and your steam fortress, those redskins would have made short work of us."
"They weren't so bad once they cozied up and had a taste of whiskey."
"Your savage respects British steel," Mallory said.
"Theories of old bones don't much impress him." "Well," Godwin said, "I'm a good party man and I'm with Lord Babbage. Theory and practice must be as bone and sinew."
"That worthy sentiment calls for another pint," said Mallory. Godwin wanted to pay.
"Pray allow me," Mallory said. "I'm still spending my bonus from the expedition."
Godwin, pint in hand, led Mallory out of earshot of the other drinkers. He gazed about carefully, then doffed his specs and looked Mallory in the eye.